Good evening, everybody. As many of you know, I'm Matt Hank. I am the chapter president of the Philadelphia chapter of the Federalist Society. I'm pleased to welcome all of you here tonight, and I'm pleased to welcome back our guest speaker, Professor Ilan Werman. Professor Werman, as many of you will remember from his last presentation to the chapter, is an associate professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. At Arizona State, he teaches administrative and constitutional law. He also writes on administrative law, separation of powers, and constitutional law, which is as good a segue as any into the discussion he's going to present to us tonight, which will be on the second founding, originalism and the 14th Amendment. Before I turn the floor over to Professor Werman, I would be remiss if I didn't say this for the benefit of those of us who are joining us for the first time. The Federalist Society believes in three principles. Number one, that the state exists to preserve individual freedom. Number two, that central separation of powers is important to that goal. And number three, that judges shouldn't make things up. It is the province of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. If you're joining us tonight and those principles have appealed to you, please go to our website and we join the Federalist Society and join the chapter. We would love to have you. Finally, on an administrative note, when we open the floor to questioning, I will give the code for CLE for those of us who've signed up for CLE. With that, Professor Werman, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks so much for having me back, and I appreciate the draw of a CLE credit. So the talk that I'm giving today is based on my new book, which I'll put here, called The Second Founding, An Introduction to the 14th Amendment. And the overarching argument of the book, I'm not going to talk about all of this today, but just to give you a flavor of the overarching argument of the book, is that the provisions of the 14th Amendment, due process of law, equal protection, the privileges and immunities of citizenship, aren't these broad and open-ended invitations to modern-day judges to import into the text modern-day values. It's often what it's taken to be, and it's not that. But on the other hand, these terms also don't confine us or consign us to narrowly doing what the public might have expected in 1866 when it was drafted or 1868 when it was ratified. My claim is that the central provisions of the 14th Amendment, due process of law, the protection of the laws, and the privileges and immunities of citizenship have long antebellum legal histories, and that through these legal histories, we can actually ascertain their meanings. In other words, my claim is that the 14th Amendment is written in the language of the law. And once we uncover this legal language, it turns out that this legal language solves the problems that were confronting the framers in the 39th Congress. Namely, one of the big problems was the comity rights of free Black citizens. If you're a free Black citizen of Massachusetts traveling in South Carolina, is South Carolina going to give you all the privileges and immunities of citizens of South Carolina? There's a clause in the original Constitution, Article 4, the Comity Clause, that seems to say, yes, they have to be given the same rights. But of course, South Carolina got around this. There was a huge problem with widespread private violence, mob rule against abolitionists and free people and free Blacks and others. And then there was a problem of discrimination in the South after abolition in the so-called Black Codes. And my claim is the legal language of these provisions directly solves these three principal problems. And therefore, I think the meaning clearly must be its legal meaning. And this legal meaning charts the satisfying middle course between these two extremes of it. Just these are, is it open textured, open-ended language that lets judges do whatever they want, or, you know, we're narrowly confined to what the public thought in 1868. One other note of introduction, by the way, methodologically, this is quite innovative. This is quite new. Most originalist scholars on the 14th Amendment rely on the legislative history. thousands of pages of legislative history, and they look for stray statements in support of particular views. So we'll come back to this. Supporters of incorporation of the Bill of Rights against the states tend to rely on a single statement from a single senator when the 14th Amendment was introduced as justifying incorporation of the Bill of Rights against the states. I think I might be the only originalist under the age of 60 who still thinks incorporation was actually wrong for reasons that I'll explain in the course of the talk. Other originalists like Randy Barnett and Evan Burnick rely heavily on anti-slavery constitutional thought, abolitionist constitutionalism, which they argue was unorthodox, but ultimately became orthodoxy among the Republican Party. And then, of course, there are others, you know, who focus on the original expected application and what the public thought in 1868 about things like school segregation. Well, my claim is they're all wrong. My claim is the key to uncovering the meaning of the 14th Amendment is to understand that it's written in the language of the law, that they have these terms have these long antebellum legal histories, and their meanings are ascertainable from those histories. Okay, I can't do all of that in 20 minutes. And I want to keep it 20 minutes because I'm sure this will stoke questions among lawyers such as yourself. So for the rest of this talk, I want to make a particular claim about the Privileges or Immunities Clause. The clause that says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. You may have heard that this clause incorporates the Bill of Rights against the states. This is Kurt Lash's view. It's Akilah Maher's view. Michael K. Curtis's view. In fact, I think it's fair to say that today, most originalists believe that incorporation of the Bill of Rights is actually against the states is actually correct as a matter of original meaning, not under the substantive due process, which is what they do today, but under the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Others like Randy Barnett say the clause not only incorporates the Bill of Rights against the states, but also protects unenumerated fundamental rights, such as contract rights, property rights, and so on, the stuff of Lochner v. New York, right? The economic substantive due process. So I think it's fair to say today that the debate is largely between those who think it only incorporates the Bill of Rights or also protects other unenumerated fundamental rights. My claim, the argument I make in the book, is that the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause likely does neither. My claim is that the Privileges or Immunities Clause does not guarantee any fundamental rights at all. My claim is that the Privileges or Immunities Clause is an anti-discrimination provision with respect to civil rights under state law. If I'm right about this, what are the implications, by the way? I think that means California can ban handguns. What it can't say is only African-American citizens can't own handguns. I think California can shape the content of its contract law as much as it wants. What it can't say is you can't operate a laundromat in a wood building if it turns out only Chinese citizens operate laundromats in wood buildings. So that's a variation on an actual case. In other words, it merely requires non-discrimination. It merely requires equality in the provision of civil rights under state law. Okay, that kind of sounds like a radical claim. What is my evidence for it? What is my evidence for it? Well, today I'd like to cover two pieces of evidence. The first and most important is the Civil Rights Act of 1866. It is beyond dispute, right? It is indisputable that the key objective of the 14th Amendment, at a minimum, was to constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And my argument is only the anti-discrimination reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause does the trick. You may be thinking, well, wait a minute, what about the Equal Protection Clause? Doesn't equal protection require equality? Well, it turns out equal protection does not mean what you all learned it means in law schools. I think equal protection is much narrower, and it does not succeed in constitutionalizing the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Only the anti-discrimination reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause does. The second thing I'll talk about in a much briefer period is the historical problem. A lot of pro-incorporation scholars say, well, look at the serious historical problem of the infringement on civil liberties in the South and elsewhere, the free speech and free press rights of abolitionists, the Second Amendment rights of the freed people and others in the South. And I don't disagree that that was a serious problem. What I claim is that the anti-discrimination reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause actually solves the problem. It actually solves the problem that they were confronting. Incorporation is simply not necessary to do the job. Okay, so let's start with the Civil Rights Act of 1866. This is the most important piece of this puzzle. Excuse me. At least 18 members of the 39th Congress explicitly connected the objective of the 14th Amendment, right, the 14th Amendment, I should say, with the objective of constitutionalizing the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Why is this important? What was the Civil Rights Act? What was it? What did it do? Well, it was an attack. It was an attempt to nullify and neuter the various so-called black codes that had arisen in the South after abolition, which tried which systematically denied the newly freed men and women, the newly freed people, the same civil rights that white citizens enjoyed. So, for example, freed people, the newly freed men and women, could not own real property. In some states, they could only, in some of the black codes, they could only rent in incorporated parts of the town under the supervision of the town authorities. In many of these black codes, in most of them, in fact, it could be all of them, the freed people, the newly freed men and women, these black Americans, had to enter into certain kinds of contracts, usually agricultural contracts, by the 1st of January, or the first week of January, a certain date in January each year. And if they didn't, they'd be deemed vagrants, subject to being forced into labor. And in many of these states, they couldn't testify to the same extent that whites could, and they couldn't own guns the same extent whites could. So there were prohibitions on keeping dirks, daggers, swords, firearms, and ammunition of any kind. Sometimes you could get a license from a county judge on the testimony to the good character of the black person, right? By two respectable citizens, which we all know what that means. Hence, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 declared, and here I guess I should pull it up, that all persons, hold on, sorry, okay, that all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, and excluding Indians not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States and such citizens of every race and color. Again, what citizens? Such citizens of the United States. Such citizens of the United States of every race and color shall have the same right in every state to make and enforce contracts, to sue, be parties, and give evidence, to inherit, purchase, lease, sell, hold, and convey real and personal property as is enjoyed by white citizens. Okay. Note what the Civil Rights Act does and doesn't do. It doesn't guarantee any fundamental rights at all. It doesn't define any of the rights it lists. It merely says that whatever civil rights a state happens to accord its white citizens, it must also accord its black and other citizens on equal terms, free of arbitrary discrimination. Note also the terminology. Kurt Lash argues that the term privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States was a term of art referencing the Bill of Rights and other federal constitutional rights, privileges that we have only by virtue of the federal part, sort of our citizenship. And it sounds plausible, but note how the term is used in the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act, like the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment, declares persons born in the United States to be citizens of the United States, and then says such citizens of the United States shall have the same right in every state, right, shall have equality with respect to these civil rights under state law. Andrew Johnson, by the way, who vetoed the Civil Rights Act, explain in his veto message that the bill contains an enumeration of the rights of the classes so made citizens, right? Enumeration of the rights to be enjoyed by the classes, those classes so made citizens. Again, what citizens? Well, it made them citizens of the United States. Well, and Johnson said, and these privileges of these US citizens was equality with respect to all these state-defined privileges and immunities. Now, Andrew Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Act of 1866 precisely because he thought there was no federal power over civil rights under state law. And he was probably right about that. Even the key drafters of the Civil Rights Act thought, hey, we probably don't have constitutional authority for this. But that's why we need the 14th Amendment, and particularly the Privileges or Immunities Clause, to constitutionalize it. By the way, even if this was enforcement power under the 13th Amendment, the abolition, right, it's what happens when the Democrats get in power, right, as they did in 1874, right? So we also needed to protect the gains of the Civil Rights Act. We needed to entrench them against, you know, future Democratic majorities that might repeal them. Or as then Representative and future President James Garfield said, we have to fix these in the eternal firmament of the Constitution. Okay, well, wait a minute. Doesn't the Equal Protection Clause constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866? Isn't the Equal Protection Clause what guarantees and requires equal laws? Well, I hate to break it to you. Again, the Equal Protection Clause does not mean whatever is fair or just or equal. It doesn't require equal laws. It doesn't mean what you believed it to mean. It requires something, what you were led to believe it means. It requires something, equality in something very important, but quite narrow. Equality in the protection of the laws. What was the protection of the laws? Well, in a nutshell, the protection of the laws was the flip side of due process of law. What was due process of law? Again, in a nutshell, due process of law says only the government can take away your life, liberty, and property, and only on two conditions. Only according to established law. So there must be law that you violated. The legislature can't just say, you know, go to the Tower of London because you did something yesterday that we didn't like if it wasn't a crime. Right? There must be established law that is violated. And one's violation of that established law must be adjudicated according to certain fundamental procedures, or at a minimum, according to procedures and processes that are known and established in the law. That's it. By the way, you can tell from this discussion that I argue there is no substantive due process. But I don't have, there's much more to be said about that. And if I were there in person, I would have copies of my book and I would tell you, get the book if you want the rest of that argument on due process. But the protection of the laws was the flip side of due process of law. The protection of the laws was the legal protection that the government had to give you against private interference with your private rights to life, liberty, and property. It was to protect you against private people, other private citizens, non-governmental actors who would interfere with your rights, your exercise and enjoyment of your rights to life, liberty, and property. The quintessential violation of the protection of the laws was mob rule, Lynch's law, if you will, private violence. Again, these mobs would try to deprive you of your life for your liberty without due process of law. It was just private people doing it. The protection of the laws was the legal protection against that. So the government had to give you protection against that. And then the second component of it was judicial remedies. So when a private person did interfere with your rights, committed a tort, trespass, battery, assault, conversion of property, what have you, you were entitled to assert and recover and vindicate your rights in court with judicial remedies when other private people interfered with your rights. Okay, you don't believe me? I'm still young, not a particularly established scholar. Take it on the testimony of two slightly more established scholars in their career. I refer to, of course, William Blackstone and Chief Justice Marshall. Here's what they said about the protection of the laws. When Blackstone discussed the, quote, remedial part of the law, he said that the method of recovering and asserting rights when wrongfully withheld or invaded is what we mean when we speak of the protection of the law. Remedial rights, that's what protection of the law is about. And in Marbury v. Madison, Chief Justice John Marshall wrote that the very essence of civil liberty certainly consists in the right of every individual to claim the protection of the laws whenever he receives an injury. Whenever he receives an injury. So the Equal Protection Clause, or I should say, the Equal Protection of the Laws Clause, doesn't constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866, because your rights can be terribly unequal. Your rights to liberty, your property rights could be terribly unequal on any sort of arbitrary basis. What the protection of the laws guarantees is that the government will come in and supply legal protection so you may enjoy and exercise whatever rights you happen to have, no matter how unequal those rights happen to be. Whatever rights you have will give you legal protection, but that doesn't guarantee equal rights. Something else must constitutionalize the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The only candidate is the Privileges or Immunities Clause. As I just explained, due process doesn't seem to do it. The protection of the laws doesn't seem to do it. The Privileges or Immunities Clause is written and with the Citizenship Clause in parallel language to the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And it seems to me must be what accomplishes this anti-discrimination work. Okay, so this takes me to my second shorter point, responding to the historical analyses of Professors Akhila Mar, Michael Kent Curtis, and others in the modern literature about the infringement of civil liberties. It's true, there was a tremendous problem with the abridgment of free speech and press rights against especially abolitionists. By the way, this led to the best Republican Party slogan of all time in 1856. Free speech, free press, free soil, free men, and Fremont. Okay, after John C. Fremont, who was the candidate. So this obviously greatly concerned the Republican Party, and of course the newly freed men and women were denied Second Amendment rights. But the anti-discrimination reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause solves this problem. You don't need incorporation, because free speech, gun rights, all of these things were privileges and immunities based in state law. They were civil rights under state law. The problem wasn't that the Southern state governments didn't have First Amendment protections. They all did. And white citizens all had Second Amendment protections. The problem, rather, was that the states were selectively denying these rights to certain persons, to certain populations, to abolitionists and to the freed people. Well, the anti-discrimination reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause solves that problem. By the way, just to supply evidence that the concern here really was equality, I want to quote, if I can find here where it is in my notes. Here we go. The abolitionist Elijah Lovejoy, famous abolitionist, he had four of his printing presses destroyed by an anti-abolitionist mob, and the fourth mob murdered him in the process of destroying his first printing press. Days before he was murdered by this mob, he pleaded with the town of Alton to provide him protection. He said, no one denies that I have these rights. I have these speech rights. I have these press rights. That is not the question. He said, the question to be decided is whether I shall be protected in the exercise and enjoyment of those known rights. That is the question, sir, whether my property shall be protected, whether I shall be suffered to go home to my family at night without being assailed and threatened with tarred feathers and assassination. That was the problem. So the anti-discrimination reading solves the problem, because now the states must give these civil rights equally to abolitionists as to non-abolitionists, to Black persons and white persons. And then the Equal Protection Clause says, and we will protect you against private interference with those rights. That was the problem. You just don't need incorporation to solve those historical problems. the anti-discrimination reading solves it. Okay. Let me conclude, semi-conclude, with some implications of this. I've already discussed some of the implications for incorporation, which I think largely, maybe not entirely, but largely goes out the window. What does this mean for economic substantive due process? What does this mean for Lochner? I think Lochner was wrong. Lochner was wrongly decided. Again, that was the infamous case in which the Supreme Court struck down a democratically enacted New York state law that limited the number of hours bakers could work in a day as infringing some unwritten fundamental right of contract. There's no protection. There's no absolute guarantee as a result of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Right? As long as civil rights are given equally, then I think the state is allowed to regulate, even unreasonably, as long as it's unreasonable toward everybody. And in the Lochner case, again, there was no plausible case of discrimination. It was a generally applicable, neutral law that everyone had a fair opportunity to conform to. Do these laws favor certain groups over others? Yes, of course. It favored the established bakers over the immigrant bakers who were working longer hours and undercutting their prices. Yeah, of course. Of course. But it was still, nevertheless, a generally applicable regulation to which everybody could conform. I don't think that's a discrimination. I don't think the clause covers that. But just because Lochner was wrong doesn't mean Slaughterhouse was right. I think Slaughterhouse was also wrong. Slaughterhouse was this grant of a slaughterhouse monopoly to a favored group of butchers in New Orleans. A monopoly was a classic discrimination at common law because there's literally nothing you could do to conform to the regulation. It literally gave more privileges to certain American citizens that were arbitrarily denied to similarly situated citizens merely by grant of this exclusive legal monopoly. That is a classic case of an abridgment, giving some American citizens more privileges and immunities than other similarly situated citizens. So Lochner was wrong, but I think so was Slaughterhouse. I think so was Slaughterhouse. All right, what about Brown v. Board and Obergefell? School desegregation and same-sex marriage. Well, I think Brown v. Board is an easy case under my reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. Was public education a civil right under state law? Well, it's not a political right. And I didn't talk about this today, but I talk about it in my book and in the Comity Clause, the Privileges and Immunities Clause that I hinted at earlier. The distinction was between civil rights, which are privileges and immunities, and political rights, which are not, like voting, holding office. Right? Is public education a political right? I don't think so. I think it's a civil right. It's a civil right under state law. And I think that means that Kansas and wherever, Arkansas, has to give that privilege equally. Okay, well, the separate equal? Give me a break. That's actually, I think, an easy part of the case. Once judges are no longer willfully blind to what everyone sees as men and women, what everyone knew at the time, what the Southerners who enacted Jim Crow knew, that these racial segregation laws, these Jim Crow laws, were not enacted to keep the two races separate and happy, but they were enacted to keep one race in perpetual subordination and inferiority to another. Or, as Justice Harlan said in Plessy v. Ferguson in dissent, these laws are not enacted to keep the white man from the black so much as to keep the black from the white. So once that's recognized, I think racial discrimination, the separate but equal, is just a smokescreen for abridging the privileges and immunities of a whole class of citizens, inherently giving them less rights and less privileges and less civil rights. I think Brown v. Board is actually an easy case. What about Obergefell? Okay, Obergefell, not a foolproof case, but it's plausible. You can make a plausible case. I don't think it's easy, but you can make a plausible case. What if the Supreme Court had written a two-page opinion, two-paragraph opinion along these lines? The Privileges or Immunities Clause is an anti-discrimination provision with respect to civil rights under state law. Marriage is not a political right, so it's a civil right under state law and comes with lots of other privileges and immunities. Now, this doesn't mean no discrimination is allowed, right? Just you're not allowed to do arbitrary discrimination. So 16-year-olds can't drink, 14-year-olds can't drive. I mean, you can have reasonable discrimination, right? But once it's recognized that gay citizens, that being gay isn't a choice, that it's not reasonable to ask gay citizens to marry persons of the opposite sex to obtain these privileges and civil rights. Okay. Foolproof case? No, because you can reasonably believe that marriage should be limited to one man and one woman. I think there are reasonable arguments for that. All I'm saying is, isn't it at least plausible, at least if the Supreme Court had written an opinion like that, wouldn't we have at least gotten the impression that the Supreme Court was doing an honest attempt at applying and interpreting law, as opposed to just making it up altogether, which I think is the only fair reading of Justice Kennedy's opinion. It's just making it up. That's not law. Okay, so let me conclude. So my claim in short is that the anti-discrimination reading is the best reading of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And by the way, I think it's the only reading that gets us Brown v. Board. And I think it's the only reading that makes a plausible case for Obergefell. Due process doesn't get us there. Equal protection doesn't get us there. Those don't define rights. It just explains how rights are to be taken away. It doesn't define the content of the rights. Substantive due process, I don't think, does much for either of them. Certainly not Obergefell. And incorporation, none of these cases has anything to do with the Bill of Rights. So I think only the Privileges or Immunities Clause does the trick. Well, so if I'm right, then not only is the anti-discrimination reading of the clause, I think, the best reading of the clause, maybe it's also the reading we should like the best. Maybe it would be a better world. Okay, and that's all I have. That's, in a nutshell, the book. And so I look forward to questions. And for those of you who made it this far, I'm sure you'll be getting a CLE code. I better not see a huge drop-off after that. But Matt, take it away.
Thank you very much, Ilan. And the floor is open to questions. I would ask that you please use the Q&A box to submit your questions. And it looks like we have our first taker in the person of Sean Callahan. Sean's question is this: how about Article 4, Privileges and Immunities for Incorporation? And if no incorporation, how about an act of Congress? Under Katzenbach, can Congress do that?
Okay, that is a very good question. So I talk about Article 4, which I think actually supports my reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause. So the Article 4 comedy clause in the original Constitution says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to the privileges and to all privileges and immunities of the citizens in the several states. What did this mean? Well, it was the comedy clause. What it meant was a citizen of Massachusetts traveling in another state, say Georgia, was entitled to all the privileges and immunities in Georgia that Georgia accorded its own citizens. If Georgia didn't allow guns, that's fine. But if Georgia allowed keeping and bearing arms, it couldn't say, well, if you're from Massachusetts, you've got to put your guns at the door. Whatever rights the citizens of Georgia had, the citizens of Massachusetts traveling in Georgia also had. The comedy clause was about comedy. It was an anti-discrimination provision with respect to civil rights under state law. The discrimination was interstate. The discrimination against citizens from out of state. My whole claim is what the Privileges and Immunities Clause did for interstate discrimination, the Privileges or Immunities Clause does for intrastate discrimination. And I go through the history of Privileges or Immunities Clause. They're all about anti-discrimination. They say group X gets the same rights, whatever they may be, as group Y. So I don't think, to answer your question, I don't know, by the way, if you've read Randy Barnett, the question certainly seems inspired by Randy Barnett. He claims that abolitionist thinkers, David Upham also claims this, changed the meaning of the comedy clause, that they had unorthodox meanings, that the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states imply that there was a national set of minimum fundamental privileges and immunities. That's certainly true. There was that unorthodox strain of thinking, but it was unorthodox. And I've debated Evan Burnick and Randy's co-author on this. And he even says, yes, they were unorthodox, but we think you know, the unorthodoxy became orthodoxy in the 39th Congress. And I don't see evidence for that. I think it was unorthodox. I think it stayed unorthodox. So that's a good question. Now, could Congress do it under cases like Katzenbach? I can't remember which Katzenbach, maybe it was Morgan or something. And the short answer is no. I think Congress does get wide leeway in enforcing the 14th Amendment through its enforcement power when it comes to certain things like the protection of the laws. Protection of the laws requires ongoing affirmative government action. So surely Congress is the better body to decide whether ongoing government action has been sufficient to supply protection of the laws. And if Congress says no, it supplied its own, it could supply its own courts. That's how it supplied the Freedmen's Bureau courts. It said there's a denial of the protection of the laws. So we are going to create a system of federal courts in the Freedmen's Bureau where the freedmen and women can vindicate their rights. We will prosecute offenses and so on. But if incorporation is wrong, then there's nothing to enforce. Because if a state violates or decides we are not going to have gun rights, there's nothing in the 14th Amendment says they can't do that. And so there's nothing for Congress to enforce at that point. So the civil rights cases were wrong to say the 14th Amendment is not concerned with private invasions of private rights. That's what equal protection is. That's what literally protection of the laws was about, state inaction. But they were right about the proposition that it, nevertheless, the enforcement power is remedial. I do think that's true. So I don't think Congress can just create incorporation.
All right, we have a second question. This one is from Michael Miller, who asked this. Does your view of the 14th Amendment have anything to say about the recent intra-conservative debate about whether preborn children are persons under the amendment?
So it does say something. Well, I don't think it says anything about that specific question. It is relevant to it, though, because a lot of people will say even if a prenatal life is a person, it's not state action that's depriving them of it, right? And so they'll often go to the due process clause. So under modern doctrine, it doesn't help because there's no state action, right? But my whole claim is the equal protection of the laws clause was about state inaction. My whole claim was the government has to affirmatively supply the protection of the laws to persons, to life and liberty. So if a prenatal life is a person, then I think the equal protection clause does trigger it, right? Would trigger that protection. Now, that doesn't take us all the way there, right? Because I haven't fully thought this out, but certain things you can't get around. Okay, once you're born, you're a person. No one disputed that, right? Now, can you extend the concept of person to a prenatal life? I don't think the answer depends on whether they happen to think that was the case in 1868 or not, because again, we're not bound to their factual assumptions about the world. If we were bound to their factual assumptions about the world, then I think separate would be equal, right? I think you don't get Loving, you don't get Brown v. Board, right? So we're not bound to their factual assumptions about the world. And if it's the morally contested whether they in fact are persons, as indicated by the fact that they're, you know, maybe have less protections if there's you don't go to jail for murder. I don't know. I have to investigate the abortion laws. Then I think it should be left probably to the democratic process still. But I don't know. It's something that strikes me as a difficult question, especially in light of the Equal Protection Clause, which says, again, government inaction triggers the clause. So it absolutely speaks to that debate. Have I resolved that debate in my own mind? I have not.
Our next question is from an anonymous attendee, and it is this. If Brown is such an easy case under your analysis, what about apparent voluntary resegregation, which appears to be emerging now on certain campuses in the forms of safe spaces, racially limited dorms, et cetera?
Well, so when you say voluntary, I suppose that means there's no state action there, right? Because again, there is some state action if it's not within the Equal Protection Clause, right? it says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, right? And so the problem with Brown v. Board is it's state sanctioned. These are public schools. By law, they're required to be segregated. Now, if by voluntary, you mean people choose to live in, you know, different parts of the state where there are people who look like them, or, you know, like historically black colleges, there's a reason there are historically black colleges. Why not have historically, you know, black elementary schools, you know, and maybe the BLM movement thinks that's better than being racially desegregated. And I think the answer from a 14th Amendment perspective is, as long as it's voluntary, I'm not sure, you know, because it has nothing to do with protection of the laws. It has to do with defining rights, which does have the state action component, make or enforce any law. And so if it is voluntary, you know, that's one thing. The harder question is if the state today says, well, we actually, you know, the black population wants historically black only schools. They think they'll do better. There's less racism. That starts to get really tricky. And my instinct is they can't do that. Can you imagine a world in which the privileges and immunities really would be equal? Maybe if the state established, or, you know, just like they can establish single sex education, that's actually okay as long as people have a choice. It's actually, it would be unconstitutional to say women have to go to an all-girls school, boys have to go to an all-boys school, but you're allowed to have all-boys schools and all-girls schools as long as there's a choice. So you can imagine that kind of world. So those are just musings on this very tough question, which I agree, it's amazing to see how much we've come full circle from 70 years ago, how people do seem to want segregation in many respects. And it strikes me as insidious. Then and today.
If I may press you, if I may press you a little bit, because I think perhaps this is where the anonymous questioner was going. You know, what about a state university or a state college that facilitates, say, racially segregated graduations, or take it a step further, dorms that are limited to one race? You know, how would your analysis apply to that scenario or those scenarios?
I mean, if we apply state to any public entity, which I think is kind of uncontroversial, I've actually not thought about that question, right? But so if you count a public university's policy as a kind of law, which it could be, it's a kind of custom, right? And custom can be law. So if it counts as law, which it might not, but if it does, then I would sue. I think those are unconstitutional. And I think it's insidious. Just think, like, if you had an all-white graduation ceremony, like, how terribly insidious would that be? And to say, well, it's okay because it's not white, it's, I don't know. So the in terms of the originalist inquiry, though, the question to me would be, is that a law? And I think it could be. Is it making or enforcing a law? And I think it could be, because custom is law, and public institutions operate through guidelines which could be considered law under the clause.
We have a question from Kazim Saeed. Quote, let's stipulate that the right interpretation of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment is yours, but it's not 1868 or even 1873 when the slaughterhouse cases were decided. Shouldn't we be chary of overruling a very long line of precedent? Even if the 1873 Supreme Court got it wrong, what are the main benefits of using the Privileges and Immunities Clause in the way you suggest? Bear with me, it's a long question. And given willful judges, will they really be cabined in the way you suggest, or will they be just as happy to invent interpretations as under the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses?
Well, I have a cop-out to this question, which is, the great thing about being an academic is I really don't care. Like, I just want to get the right answer, right? I honestly don't care that much about overturning or not overturning precedent. I'm actually just curious in the historically better answer. But in my case, as I hinted at the end, I actually think the world would be better in this regard, right? So I think it's okay if California wants to say no corporate speech, as long as it treats equally, right? I think they can ban handguns. There's something in it for conservatives too. Conservatives can get rid of suppression of evidence. They can get rid of Miranda warnings. They can get rid of Gideon if that's something that they want to do as a matter of constitutional compunction or whatever. There's room for experimentation. And God forbid, there'll be some diversity among state, you know, constitutions and the kinds of rights that they offer, you know? I mean, so I think it would actually be a better world. Now, should we be wary about overturning a long line of precedent? Yeah, of course, of course. But at the end of the day, it's just substantive due process is an ahistorical, completely made up doctrine. I think you can establish that. And is the world really going to be worse telling judges you actually can't just make this stuff up anymore? You know, which is how incorporation happens under substantive due process and so on. Look, if incorporation is right under the Privileges or Immunities Clause, then I honestly don't care if it's substantive due process or privileges or immunities. I will say, if we're gonna keep incorporation, I'd rather keep it under substantive due process because I think it's historically wrong under privileges or immunities. And we've already messed up due process. Let's not mess up privileges or immunities again, right? So I'd almost rather leave it alone. So again, those are sort of musings. Now you had something about willful judges. Actually here I can pull it up. What can I say? Judges are willful. Is this gonna cabin their discretion anymore? I mean, a little bit. Substantive due process, I don't think, cabins discretion at all. An anti-discrimination reading of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, I think, would be much more a narrow of an inquiry. Is there room for willful judging? Yes. Can you reimagine Lochner as an anti-discrimination case? Sure. There's always room for judges to manipulate. And the best we can do is hope that they take their oaths seriously. But that's a good set of questions. Very good set of questions. These are like the hardest questions I've ever gotten for this lecture, by the way. So
we have a gap in the questions. If anybody else has any other, I would encourage you to make them. But while we have this gap, I would be remiss if I did not mention that the code for CLE is originalism, which I will grant you is not a horribly original code, but it is easy for you to remember. So when you fill out your CLE form, there's originalism. Professor Werman, let me ask you this question. As I remember Randy Barnett's thesis, and it's been a while since I've read his book, and I'm no scholar, so give me some leeway here. In his view, the Constitution is the operating system for the philosophy of government reflected in the Declaration. And the Declaration says governments exist to protect inalienable rights. And when judges apply the 14th Amendment, they should start from that premise that there is a core of rights the government's designed to protect. And that is what is protected, I think he said, by the Privileges and Immunities Clause. But as I said, it's been a while since I read the book. With that build up, I have two questions. Number one, was Professor Barnett right that that is the purpose of our government, that that is what the Constitution's supposed to do? And if he is right, does your approach to the 14th Amendment perform that function?
Yeah, so, I mean, he's right. I mean, look, the Declaration of Independence was half a revolution, right? It establishes the conditions of a just regime, right? It said the existing regime is not a just regime. And here are the conditions for a just regime. Does the Constitution meet those conditions? Well, of course. Of course, the founders thought it met those conditions. At the time, there was a big problem, which is slavery, right? But certainly, I think today's Constitution meets those conditions. Could you have come up with another Constitution, 50 other kinds of constitutions that meet those conditions? Yes. The problem with Randy's thesis is that those conditions are not just about natural rights. They're also about the consent of the governed. They're also about ongoing self-government. That's what the founders were concerned about. They were concerned about consent of the governed and self-government on the one hand, banding together to deliberate over the common good, but also protecting a large measure of natural liberty to ensure that these majorities through self-government don't infringe on the rights of minorities. So the reality is the Constitution was a balancing act. These two objectives are in tension with each other. And figuring out how to do this, is not easy. Edmund Burke, okay, I'm going a little off topic here, but trust me, like this is good stuff. Edmund Burke has this passage in his Reflections on a Revolution in France, in which he says the following. To create a government requires no great prudence. Settle the seat of power, compel obedience, and the work is done. To create freedom, Burke said, is easier still. It is not necessary to guide. All it requires is to let go the reins. But to form a free government, that is, to form a constitution that balances, that tempers these competing objectives of liberty and restraint in one consistent work requires a sagacious, powerful, combining mind. Okay, that was almost an exact quote. I think I got bits and pieces of it wrong. But what's the point? The point is Randy is wrong to say that a key element of legitimacy is only the protection of natural rights. The short answer is it's the protection of natural rights and the enablement of self-government, a regime by which we the people can decide through representative bodies, who we want to be morally, politically, socially, culturally, economically, while also preserving a large measure of natural. So why should we interpret the Constitution with this presumption of liberty as opposed to a presumption of constitutionality? They cared about both. They cared about self-government and about liberty. And I actually think, by the way, that the 14th Amendment does a pretty good job of this, to bring it back full circle. It says, look, you as the state can deliberate as a state, okay, over what rights you consider are fundamental, right, at the state level, the state civil rights. All we require as a matter of federal right, federal constitutional right, is that you treat your citizens equally, with equal respect under the law. That, I think, is absolutely the right balance between self-government and liberty when it comes to the federal say over state constitutions and state rights. I think it's a great balance. My ideas sound radical in a way, but they're radical in the sense that I think the 14th Amendment was less radical than modern day scholars think. I don't think it was intended to fundamentally alter the federal state relation. I mean, I do think it, in some respects it was. That's why I call it a second founding. Now, as a matter of federal right, you could assert equality with respect to civil rights under state law, due process rights, and equal protection. But in terms of the content of your liberty and property rights, it was still up to the states. They could still experiment with contract rights, property rights, regulations, economic regulations, gun rights. They could still experiment. And I think that was a good balance. I think it was a very good balance.
All right, well,
sorry, this is filibustering.
No, you did. That was an excellent answer, and I never ask a follow-up to anybody who can quote Burke at length. So I will turn to our last question, which is from an anonymous attendee. Can Professor Worman briefly outline what the antebellum or pre-revolutionary historical legal meaning of privileges and immunities was that informs his perspective? How does he respond to the critic who says that privileges refers to legal, for example, testimonial privileges, spousal, attorney-client, et cetera, and immunities, for example, immunity from prosecution?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the short answer is the comity clause jurisprudence. So the comity clause jurisprudence, again, dealt with a clause that says the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of the citizens of the several states, to a similar clause in the Articles of Confederation that also required equality in the provision of these civil rights. And there is a robust doctrine of antebellum law. When one citizen traveled to another, of one state traveled to another state and resided there for a year, wasn't a citizen of that state yet, but was traveling there or working there or residing there, they would often be discriminated against in certain things, usually in political rights. Like you can't vote. A citizen of Massachusetts can't show up in South Carolina on election day and vote. Okay? You can go to Georgia, you can funnel your millions of dollars, you can get out the vote, you just can't vote yourself. That's still the one thing like you couldn't do. And case after case after case said the privileges and immunities of citizenship refer to civil rights, not political rights. Political rights were things that only existed by virtue of the social contract, by virtue of government. Holding office and voting were the two primary political rights. They also thought, by the way, that serving on a jury was a political right. And I find that actually kind of interesting because I certainly don't want to dispute that. But what they said is civil rights were covered. Civil rights were the privileges and immunities of citizenship. What were civil rights? Civil rights were just every single natural right you had in the state of nature that you then enter into civil society, and civil society protects those rights, modifies those rights, elaborates on those rights through the law, contract law, property law, what have. But the point is, they don't depend on government for existence. Civil rights are just natural law as modified and elaborated and protected by the civil law, by law. And that was the distinction. Case after case after case distinguished. Civil rights, not political rights. And I go through this history in chapter 3 of my book, which, by the way, since I know we said this was the last question, my book is only 144 pages long. So I do all of this in just 144 pages. And it's only $20 on Amazon. If you had me in person, maybe another time, I would sell them at a discount and I would inscribe them for you. But nevertheless, I do hope that some of you pick up the book. And of course, I would welcome continuing the conversation via email. I'm just very grateful that there was such a good attendance for one of probably, hopefully, the last Zoom events any of us will ever have to have. But.
Well, Professor Warman, we are thankful and grateful to you for joining us this evening. We're also thankful to all the members who joined us this evening. Both the incoming president, Steve Lee, and I are anxious to get back to in-person events. We will do it as soon as we possibly can, I assure you. Unfortunately, we're just not quite there yet. But thank you for hanging in there with us on a Zoom presentation. And it is our fond desire that our next event be in person. Once again, I'll remind you the code for CLE is originalism. Thank you, all of you, for being here. And Professor Warman, thank you again. Have a good evening.
Thanks for having me.